KZSU, Stanford University. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and I thank you for joining me today on KZSU's Hearsay Culture. Today I'm very excited to have on the author of a book that will cover an industry that is near and dear to the hearts of many people, or perhaps not so dear, but certainly near to the hearts of many of the people who listen to KZSU. Terry Fisher, professor of law at Harvard Law School, wrote a fascinating book a couple of years ago called Promises to Keep, subtitled Technology, Law, and the Future of Entertainment. And in Terry's book, he does a quite comprehensive and quite balanced analysis of the arguments both for and against strong copyright in connection with the entertainment industry. Particularly, his focus is on music and film, although he covers the entertainment industry broadly. And there have been a number of books that have touched on these issues. In fact, I interviewed early on in Hearsay Culture's history Professor Joanna Demers from USC, who wrote a fascinating book called Steal This Music, about the impact of intellectual property law on the creation of music. But in Promises to Keep, Terry takes a look at the business side of the argument, really, and focuses heavily on strong intellectual property rights and what it means. And one of the interesting things he does, and something that we will touch on today, is, as he says in the book, to take seriously the argument of the entertainment industry that the copyright protection that the industry seeks is similar to traditional real property rights that every law student studies in their first year of law school, and that people are familiar with every time they buy or sell a house or a piece of land or really any real property. But among other interesting things that Terry does is to offer a proposed solution, which we will get into, that is controversial in many circles, and we'll ask Terry about those that solution and get his reaction not only to what some of the criticisms might be, but also since the book was written in 2004, it remains quite relevant, but things have changed a little bit since then. The Grokster decision, as well as just in the last month, the Copyright Royalty Board coming up with a set of royalty guidelines and fees with respect to webcasting, something near and dear to my heart. So I'm very excited to have on Professor Terry Fisher, who is the Hale and Dorr Professor of Intellectual Property Law at Harvard Law School, as well as the director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society, which is Harvard's version of the Center for Internet Society, in which I work, and Berkman and Stanford CIS work on projects together and often collaborate and in many ways complement each other with respect to not only advocacy but also analysis of technology law issues. So Terry is joining us by phone today from Harvard, and when we take after a short music break, we will come back with Professor Terry Fisher, author of the book Promises to Keep, subtitle Technology Law and the Future of Entertainment, on Hearsay Culture and KZSU FM. If I have done my job properly, on the other end of the line is Terry Fisher from Harvard. Terry, are you there?
I'm here.
Terrific. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Let's start right off with the question that I ask all guests up front, which is the title of the book, what it means, and how you came to write about this topic.
Well, the meaning of the principal title, Promises to Keep, is it reflects my sense, which I tried to describe in some detail in the first chapter, that the recent technological developments have created extraordinary opportunities for improvement in the way in which we both produce and distribute and consume recorded entertainment. So there's promise latent in the technology, really quite dramatic promise. And it's our job collectively to keep those promises. We haven't done so yet. And what the book aspires to do is consider different possible combinations of legal systems on the one hand and business models on the other that would realize that promise.
So it's interesting, right up front, the promise that you're speaking about in the book is not the promise of one particular segment connected with the issues that you analyze. It's a collective issue of both the industry and consumers and what have you.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, first, it's probably important to be clear what are these technologies in question, and then return to how, as you point out, everybody potentially stands to gain. The technologies familiar to most anybody who works in this field are, first, digital recording and storage system, second, compression systems like MP3 or DivX, and third, most importantly, the Internet, which makes possible rapid, simple distribution of these compressed digital recordings. Those three things together create opportunities for many more artists, both musicians and filmmakers, to make high-quality materials and to make them available to global audiences. Consumers benefit potentially enormously by getting a richer array of things more cheaply. And last but not least, the artists themselves can get a bigger slice of a of the pot and make not less money but more. So everyone, potentially the artists, the consumers, stand to gain from this technological revolution, but we have as yet failed to figure out a combination of rules and institutions that would capitalize on that potential.
In 2004, when the book came out, obviously there was the increase in knowledge about the ability of individual consumers to share files, and you discuss Kazaa and Grokster and Nutella and the other peer-to-peer services that existed at the time and since have been subject to court challenges, and some have disappeared and others have propped up in their place to some degree. But we'll get to the changes that have occurred in the last few years since the book came out. But I'm curious from your perspective as an intellectual property scholar, how you came to focus on these particular set of issues. What about them do you find fascinating or particularly intriguing?
Well, that's a good question. Some parts of this are undoubtedly idiosyncratic. I have daughters who are enmeshed in the music scene, both
right.
as musicians and consumers. So, you know, pops up constantly in household conversation. From an academic standpoint, I think the main attraction of this field is the way in which it challenges many of the foundational principles of intellectual property law. So we have, for the past, roughly speaking, 200 years in the United States, relied heavily, though not exclusively, on copyright law and patent law to encourage people to make innovations from which we all benefit. And that system has worked remarkably well. The United States is the leading innovator in a variety of fields, or at least has been and continues to be the leading producer of much popular entertainment. But it's deteriorating, this system. What my colleague Jonathan Zittrain referred to as promiscuous reproduction made possible by the new technologies are corroding the capacity of the intellectual property system to sustain this fountain of innovation. And so we, in this state of disruption, have to rethink our basic understanding for this field, and that, for a scholar of intellectual property like myself, is an enticing challenge.
Before we get into the ultimate focus of your work and the ultimate thesis of the book, I do want to touch on one part of the book, which I mentioned in the introduction, which is your chapter devoted to taking seriously, your phrase, the property rights claims of the entertainment industry. I'm curious, since the book's been out a few years and remains quite timely, if you'd be interested or willing to share any reactions in particular to that chapter that you got from those in the entertainment industry or generally?
Well, I've given presentations in many different settings of the ideas contained in the book, both before it came out and after it came out. And several of those presentations have been before exclusively entertainment companies, or they've been present in the audiences. And usually what I do is I present the array of possible solutions to the crisis, of which taking property rights, intellectual property rights, seriously is one. So what basically happens is different audiences react usually strongly to the relative merits of the roads I sketch, and as you might expect, most until quite recently, this is something I want to come back to, but until quite recently, most representatives of the recording companies and the film studios strongly endorse the path sketched in Chapter 4, just taking property rights seriously, mm-hmm. and have been very skeptical of the path sketched in the last chapter, which contemplates replacing the intellectual property system vis-a-vis digital recordings with a compulsory licensing model. So maybe we go back to, and as you suggest, stick for a moment with the taking property rights seriously. What would that entail?
Right.
Well, there are two strands to this approach, and I certainly didn't invent these. I just made an effort in the book to catalog them. But the two main strands are make a set of rights that you get as a copyright owner parallel those of a owner of a piece of land.
Mm-hmm.
That's one strand. And the other strand is to use the legal system to reinforce copyright owners' ability to engage in self-help practices to shield their works.
Can you, for the benefit of the listeners who are not attorneys, self-help has a particular meaning when it comes to what we're describing. If you wouldn't mind just defining that.
Yeah. So, well, in the land context, best being seen by example, I think,
mm-hmm.
in the context of land, we grant landowners a fair amount of latitude that we don't grant to most people to shield their own property. So, for example, if a trespasser comes onto your property, you're allowed to use non-lethal force to expel them. And if somebody breaks into your home, you are given more latitude to use up to deadly force than you would if you're not in your home. And there are a variety of other ways in which the legal system will back up the efforts of a landowner to undertake his own. His or her own protective action to shield the castle.
Mm-hmm.
So analogously in the intellectual property space, many, not all copyright owners, seeing their legal rights in practice erode as it becomes ever more difficult to enforce their copyrights, have turned instead to technology. To technological protection systems, or what is sometimes known as digital rights management systems,
mm-hmm.
To shield their works. So, for example, the CSS system that shields DVDs from being copied, or the systems used by very streaming media companies to prevent non-permissive copying. Those are all technological, you can think of as self-help approaches. Just as landowners confront people who don't respect their boundaries, so analogously copyright owners confront people who seek to crack the encryption systems.
Mm-hmm.
And the legal system can come to their aid. And in the United States, and more recently in Europe, has done so with the so-called Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which imposes fairly serious penalties on people who either circumvent encryption or traffic in technologies that enable others to circumvent. So that's stuff we've done already, and you could go a good deal further down this road if you wanted to pursue the self-help option.
Right.
So, for example, you could, as some people have suggested in the past, authorize copyright owners to cede the unlawful peer-to-peer distribution systems, not only with false files, which they already do, sort of spoofs, but with more malicious things, that would carry viruses and would harm the computers of people who, without permission, copy copyrighted materials. That would be a form of self-help, a little like in the 18th century, people sometimes, on occasion, used spring guns.
Right.
They're little devices that would automatically shoot an intruder until the legal system concluded that this was excessively harsh.
But fortunately, for the benefit of law students who came since, it's one of the more interesting illustrative examples of the limits of self-help and property.
Exactly.
With that background, I think we can take the next step into the ultimate thesis of the book. And I guess I'll ask the question this way, and it's a broad question, which is, as you see it, what is the main issue or problem with the operations of the entertainment industry and the copyright system in tandem? And again, I recognize this is a broad question. What is, in brief, what is the solution that you propose in your book?
The principal problem is that we have collectively sought during the last 10 years to patch up the copyright system to address the corrosive effects of these new technologies. Patch it up by, for example, tightening the rules governing secondary liability. You referred in your introduction to the Grokster case decided by the Supreme Court recently.
Mm-hmm.
That's just one example of a variety of ways in which we have sought to tighten the standards governing copyright infringement so as to reduce the frequency with which people reproduce or publicly perform other people's works.
Mm-hmm.
This tightening has frustrated the emergence of many new and more efficient business models, but at the same time hasn't saved the old business model. So the revenues of the film industry continue to decline. Excuse me, the revenues of the music industry continue to decline, and the film industry is starting to see some corrosion. For example, worldwide box office revenues, just concentrating on the box office zone for a moment, of Hollywood went down for the first time last year. So we haven't solved the problem, but we've created lots of ancillary difficulties through our pursuit of this basic strategy of patching up the old system. And we ought to think about something quite new.
Mm-hmm.
So this brings us to your second question. So what's the bottom line of the book? Well, to repeat, I try to be objective in assessing the relative advantages and disadvantages of several possible solutions, and the one we've talked about thus far is taking intellectual property rights seriously. That has many potential benefits, but a pretty substantial set of disadvantages as well. What I argue at the end of the book is that the solution, though not perfect, has the best combination of advantages and disadvantages, is one in which we would replace the copyright system for digital recordings distributed through the Internet
mm-hmm.
Entirely with a compulsory licensing model, the gist of which is that the copyright owners, who deserve to be compensated here, would collect their money not from consumers directly, but rather from the state, from a government, which would raise that money by taxing, ideally, in the ideal scenario, by through a slight increase in the income tax, but recognizing the political impossibility, at least in the United States, of that solution, more plausibly through a tax on the devices and services that enable us to gain access to all this good stuff. So that means digital recording systems and, above all, broadband Internet access.
Whenever you raise the specter of government running something, it engenders in some a visceral reaction. And clearly, as well, challenging the operation of the copyright system requires that new ideas be explored and thought through. And obviously, I'm not asking you a new question, but since I imagine many listeners will react this way, I'm curious to get your response to the basic concern of, oh no, now we're going to ask the government to do something for us. And, you know, given the general view that people often have with regard to the government's ability to operate basic public infrastructure, what's your response to the concern based upon your proposal that the government is either incapable or simply unable to operate a system that you describe?
Yeah, so this is a really important issue. You're, of course, right that it's not a new one, that this is the biggest objection that has been leveled for many years against all compulsory licensing systems.
Right.
So there are three responses to it. The first response deals with the specter of government officials deciding which artists deserve to be paid and which don't. This is not a crazy idea, meaning it's not crazy for people to be worried about this. After all, in many European countries, government agencies do exactly that. My proposal and the proposal of other people who have worked in this space, like Professor Neil Nathanael at UCLA, takes a completely different approach. The idea is that the tax revenues would be distributed to artists not on the basis of government administrators' estimate of who's worthy, but on the basis of detailed estimates of the relative popularity of each work. And a little bit more specifically there, how frequently particular audio and video recordings get played, not sold in our current model, which is highly imperfect in this regard, but get played. So we can come back later if you want to the technology that would make this possible. There are complications lurking there, but the core idea is that artists would, under this new system, be compensated in principle the same way they are under the current system. Mm-hmm. Namely, if people like their stuff, they get paid, and if people don't, they don't. So that's the first answer that addresses one worry about the government. The second concern can't be dispensed with so easily. The second concern is, I think, the one that you were primarily referring to, namely, governments do a bad job of many things, and why would we trust a government agency to handle this especially sensitive task? That's definitely a hazard. You can mitigate it through designing an administrative agency that runs as efficiently as possible, and we've learned a good deal over the course of the 20th century about what administrative structures work well and what work badly. But even the best of administrative agencies are vulnerable to lobbying by the interest groups who clamor for increasing the shares of their own pies and so forth. And so you can mitigate these hazards, but you can't make them go away completely. So I indicated at the outset that none of these solutions is perfect. Each has some disadvantages. You have your finger on the principal disadvantage of the solution I sketch.
Mm-hmm.
All right, that's the second. And here's the third and last of the responses.
Okay.
Is, many people have had doubts concerning the feasibility of setting up and administering such a system, whether it's by a government or by anybody else. And partly to address that concern, a group of us have, with the generous seed funding from the MacArthur Foundation, been building a private analog to this model, a private company that would very efficiently gather revenue, not from individual consumers, but from Internet service providers, and distribute it on the consumption count basis that I just described to copyright owners. We have not as yet tried to establish such a system in the United States, but we've pretty far along in setting it up in China and Canada. And the aspiration will be both to demonstrate the feasibility, the technical feasibility of such a system, and at the same time, indirectly, to show how, without involving government agencies, you might implement this idea, thereby avoiding some of the notorious hazards associated with the governments you referred to at the outset.
The challenge is to, among the other challenges, is to figure out a way to set up this system that doesn't adversely impact any of the players in it. And I do, we're going to take a short music break, but I guess as a quasi-cliffhanger, I want to turn after the break to the issue of the basic business model of the entertainment industry. And take a look at some of the interesting developments that have occurred since your book came out with respect to webcast royalty rates and Grokster and innovation generally in the tech industry. So you're listening to Hearsay Culture on KZSU FM, Dave Levine, in discussion with Professor Terry Fisher from Harvard Law School regarding his book Promises to Keep. We will take a short music break and then return with Professor Fisher. John Hyatt, and one of, I think, his best albums in his huge repertoire of Crossing Muddy Waters, That's Only the Song Survives. And before that, Joni Mitchell's Free Man in Paris, an obvious choice discussing entertainment industry, as well as other many other discussions of different business models. So before we come back with Professor Terry Fisher, I do want to do what I always do at the bottom of the hour, which is to ask the listeners for money. Money for KZSU. KZSU is a non-commercial public radio station that relies on donations from listeners in order to continue airing its diverse range of programming. And if you're interested in giving money, making a donation to KZSU, you have a couple of options. One option is to go to kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. That's a good choice. Or, alternatively, speaking of alternatives that we were discussing with Professor Fisher, we will shortly in a moment, you can also simply write an email to underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. And otherwise, regardless, please do keep listening to KZSU FM. So we're back with Terry Fisher. And Terry, let's jump into that business model that has been derided by so many people. Indeed, more and more people, I think, within the entertainment industry have acknowledged its shortfalls. You make an interesting point in the book that I want to probe a little bit, which is you viewed it, and I don't want to, this is contextual, and so I'll ask you to contextualize the statement. But you felt that to allow the basic business model of the entertainment industry to die, to let the dinosaurs die, quote unquote, would be dangerously cavalier. And I want you to contextualize that statement and maybe respond to the concern that people do make, and the statement that people do make, which boils down to the phrase, "Your broken business model is not my problem."
So the context in which that particular discussion in the book arose is as follows. There are some skeptics, critics of the entertainment industry as a whole, and skeptics concerning the value of intellectual property, who argue that the peer-to-peer file-sharing revolution, which was briefly dented, but in the end not materially slowed by the Grokster decision, should be allowed to run its course, that consumers should be permitted to continue to share freely, without compensation, audio and video recordings that they obtain from a variety of sources. And it's true, some of the skeptics acknowledge that that if this trend runs its course, that musicians will no longer make significant amounts of money from their recordings, and so that segment of their income will fade away, and that segment corresponds to the entire business model of the recording companies. But we shouldn't be terribly concerned with that, because new ways of supporting art will come to the fore. And in particular, they often point out accurately that the majority of musicians now make most of their money through performances, not through recordings. And some of them, Janis Ian would be an example here, deliberately distribute free copies of all of their recordings as a kind of promotional venture, advertising for what they see as their main source of income. And so through all this, out on the basis of all this, some people say, so let the dinosaurs die, the dinosaurs being here corresponding to the recording companies and the film studios, and we will see a new ecology emerge in the ashes of the old one. That's the argument.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reason why I suggest that's dangerous and cavalier is not that I think the dinosaurs in their current form are socially optimal. It's rather that it reflects insensitivity to the importance of preserving incentives and rewards for people whose creativity we all depend upon.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a variety of kinds of music, for example, that are not really susceptible of big concerts in stadiums, electronic music, for example, where we would seriously injure artists who deserve to be compensated if we pull this particular rug out from under them. And the problem is even more serious when you turn from music to film. The chances that one could find some alternative business model to support high-quality either entertainment or documentary films without being effectively to charge people for access to copies is slim.
Mm-hmm.
So my suggestion, generally speaking, through the book, is that you have to be careful to preserve some flows of revenue to people who deserve it and upon whom we depend. Now, that doesn't mean that in the new world that exactly the same companies would survive in their current form.
Mm-hmm.
I think everyone has to acknowledge that that's extremely unlikely and would be socially disadvantageous if it happened. So we can expect and encourage the current copyright owners, the aggregators like the record companies, to become much smaller, fleeter, more efficient operations, concentrating in areas where they still have considerable value to add, namely selecting artists, promoting their work, assisting in the production of high-quality recordings and so forth. And they have much less role in the area that they have traditionally dominated, namely distribution. Similarly, we can expect film to become a good deal more diverse when we drift away from the heavily promoted blockbuster model,
mm-hmm.
Toward a more niche production and distribution system that the Internet facilitates. So the world can and should change quite dramatically, and some companies will have to adapt in this new environment. But what I was objecting to and continue to object to is the notion that we can ignore the interests of the current intermediaries, confident that something will pop up to replace their existing business models. We have to be more deliberate in ensuring that whatever world we create does offer adequate support for the people who deserve it.
It kind of segues into some of the more recent developments that I want to touch on in our remaining time. I mean, sadly, a 1 hour or even less with music and what have you time period is never enough to get into all of these issues. On the other hand, if we did what the other option on KZSU, which is a three-hour block, we might both wind up passing out. So we'll cut right to a couple of other issues that I want to get your reaction to or thoughts on. I mentioned webcast royalty rates, and for people that aren't familiar, the nutshell is the Copyright Royalties Board is the administrative arm that sets periodically the rates for internet streaming, for webcasting. And indeed, anyone that's listening to KZSU on the internet, the show is being recorded on March 21st, but if you're listening on the internet, this applies to what you're doing. The board sets royalty rates with respect to the payments that should be made to artists and labels and what have you, whenever a particular sound recording is played. The webcast royalty rates have been set. They were set a few weeks ago, and they've been subject to a lot of criticism with respect to the amounts and the impact that that would have on internet webcasters. So I'm curious, Terry, given how closely you follow the industry, what your reaction is as we stand here, as we sit here and talk today, noting, of course, that actually just yesterday it was announced that challenges have begun from NPR stations and what have you, but emphasizing that we're having this discussion on March 21st, 2007, what's your reaction to where we are?
The rates are too high. The new rates are too high. A little background here is the proceeding, the board proceeding you referred to is actually the second round. The first round was about 3 years ago now, when for the very first time the rates paid by webcasters were set. I actually testified in that proceeding on behalf of the webcasters and tried to suggest some possible trajectories of the webcasting industry. And cut to the chase here, thought that the most socially desirable model that was well within the contemplation of Congress when it set up this system was one in which the rates would be kept quite low initially to allow this infant industry to develop, and then once its superiority to traditional forms of radio broadcast has been established, then gradually to raise the rates to ensure that artists are fairly compensated. And that it would be unfortunate if the rates were set so high in the beginning that the infant enterprises, many of them amateur, couldn't afford them and were driven out of business. And that, unfortunately, my recommendation on the score didn't get a lot of play in the initial proceeding. The rates were set too high there, and there was a last-minute compromise that reduced the rates significantly for the smallest of the webcasters. We are now, I'm afraid, on track to establish even higher rates in the next round. Now, if there's only any justification for this, it's the record companies through their intermediary sound exchange fear that if the rates are set very low in the beginning, they're going to have trouble raising them later. And there's some precedent for that, what has happened through the administration of Section 115 of the copyright statute. So there's a legitimate worry. But
and Section 115 for the listeners is?
That sets the rate that you have to pay a composer if you make a cover of his or her song. It's a similar compulsory licensing that the recording industry is happy about. So analogously there, the rates were set very low early in the 20th century and have not been raised as far as they should have been, because it's hard to change rates through a political process. So the recording industry in this particular instance is worried about that, and that's a legitimate concern. But their legitimate concern, when implemented, I think is going to badly damage the infant webcasting industry.
And indeed, to follow, I mean, even to follow up on that, the first time that this was going on, a few years ago, a lot of radio stations simply abandoned the enterprise, and there was suddenly, you know, in a matter of a couple of weeks, as copyright concerns were raised and cost concerns, came up, stations were just not streaming. And it's a sad development. Do you expect, notwithstanding what you just said, do you think that the argument that this infant industry should be allowed to flourish can possibly gain currency in the event the challenges are raised or these issues are reconsidered?
It's conceivable, but to be honest, I'm not involved in the challenges, so I don't know about the prospects on that score.
Let's turn to Grokster, which we mentioned briefly, and we can go to in a little bit more detail. I guess the nutshell question is, when you were writing your book, the Supreme Court hadn't made its ruling. It since has. And does the ruling of the Supreme Court in Grokster alter any of the analyses or recommendations that you made in your book?
Not much. Grokster did represent one example of the kind of tightening of the copyright system that that I described as the main thrust of the industry at the time. But in the end, the decision represents only a modest change in the rules governing secondary liability, governing the liability of people who don't themselves violate the copyright statute but that enable other people to do so. In the before the Supreme Court, there were many parties who wanted to alter the law radically on this issue and to extend liability to enterprises that that didn't embed in their technology sufficient precautions to prevent infringement. In the end, what the Supreme Court did was something much more modest. They basically said that if you have a dual-use technology, something that has legitimate uses but also illegal uses, you are liable for secondary infringement if you actively encourage or promote its illegal uses through advertising and instruction and so forth. And the result is that, fortunately, in my view, it means that the operators of dual-use technologies that don't engage in this active promotion are not adversely affected by the decision. So in the long-term effect of Grokster will be to curb aggressive deployment of dual-use technologies, including the kinds of instruction for how to copy copyrighted materials that Grokster itself was engaged in. But other technologies with more general uses, like BitTorrent, are not threatened by the decision.
You know, I do want to ask you, because I was actually rereading it last night. As you know, Professor Lessig, who you know well, and who I work for, had an op-ed piece in the New York Times this past Sunday. And he, to summarize his piece, he brought up the concern that the locus of change with respect to copyright law has been moved from the legislative arena to the judicial arena with respect to, because of, and the precedent being set by the Grokster decision. And I'm curious to get your reaction to that concern.
Well, to be honest, I'm somewhat less worried on this score than Larry is. He pointed out in that op-ed the contrast between the Supreme Court's reticence in the Sony Betamax case, where they said basically leave the issue to Congress, and with Grokster, where the Supreme Court, despite the fact that Congress was considering this very question, went forward and announced an inducement standard. So he's right that the court was more aggressive in wading into this area in Grokster than it was in Sony. On the other hand, as I tried to suggest, the kind of intervention the Supreme Court made in Grokster was actually quite modest, and much more modest than many of the plaintiffs and their supporters had asked for.
The and indeed, with respect to the Grokster decision, it is fascinating to find that people that, at least I found, that both scholars as well as practitioners who generally agree on the general view with respect to strong copyright in the entertainment industry do have a quite wide-ranging opinions about just how bad Grokster was. And I think I'm more in your camp with respect to thinking about how bad it could have been had it gone another way. Let's touch in the remaining few minutes that we have on another major issue, which we've discussed briefly, but in a little bit more detail now, which is digital rights management. And I, again, the broad question in a couple of minutes, with DRM being both stronger and more capable in terms of its features than it was in 2004, and yet now it seems to be under at least increasing attack, even from people to some degree like Steve Jobs at Apple. What's your opinion on DRM today as a result of these more recent developments?
My sense is, actually, on this particular issue, I have even stronger views than I did when I first wrote the book, that the disadvantages of digital rights management are even more apparent now than they were before. So now, to be specific here, what we're talking about is digital rights management in the sense of technological protection measures that limit what you can do with your files, rather than digital rights management in the sense of keeping proper attribution. So, having sharpened the issue slightly, here are the problems associated with it. First, it doesn't work. Even the best efforts here are cracked reasonably promptly, sometimes by 12-year-old Norwegians, sometimes by Princeton computer scientists. The most recent example is the Blu-ray copyright protection system, which was cracked quite recently. Mm-hmm. So, it doesn't work at the software level. At least no one has thus far been able to make it work. Second problem, it could work at the hardware level. And this was Disney's proposal some time ago, a piece of legislation that was proposed but not adopted, that would have required all consumer electronics manufacturers to embed in their machines hardware that would respect watermarks. Mm-hmm. That would work. The trouble with it is it would have the effect of locking down the machines against the flexibility that consumers want to put to them in a way that would frustrate all sorts of innovations with the devices, something my colleague Jonathan Zittrain writes a lot about. And the last problem with digital rights management is that unless it's adjusted very carefully, it can frustrate creative reuses of materials. This is what Larry Lessig refers to as the read-write culture. This is one of the great benefits of the new technologies. So all the way around, it doesn't work well, doesn't work at all in its current form. It could work at the hardware level, but that would have big disadvantages, and it impedes creativity. My view, like Steve Jobs, is that we should, if at all possible, figure out a way of solving this crisis that doesn't depend on digital rights management, and that's what I'm trying to do.
Well, indeed, and I think since we've come just about to the end of our time, it's a good time for me to say that, again, with an hour, we can't delve into everything, but I do invite you back to discuss these issues in 6 months or 9 months to see where we are. And it would be fun to continue the conversation. In the last, I do want to ask you about a project that you mentioned to me off air that you're working on. And I do want to get the opportunity to just kind of, talk a little bit about that in the last minute that we have.
So that's a project I mentioned. We're trying to build a private, voluntary system that would incorporate some features of the compulsory licensing model. It's called NoAnk Media. You can find much more information about it at noankmedia.com. And the key idea here is to persuade Internet service providers that it's in their best interest to offer their customers the kind of service that I suggested a government could institute on a compulsory basis. And thus far, many universities in particular in both China and Canada have found this idea compelling. So we have built the most pieces of the necessary technology, and we're going to be implementing it on a trial basis in China in this coming fall, and we hope, if all goes well, to implement it on a more widespread basis a year from then.
Well, I look forward to hopefully being able to chat with you about that as well, because that definitely sounds like a fascinating challenge and certainly an interesting way to see how these models would work. So I look forward to following that. I want to thank you, Terry, for being on the show today. Your book, Promises to Keep, certainly, engenders a lot of interesting discussion. And so I appreciate you taking the time today on Hearsay Culture to chat with us.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. I want to thank Terry Fisher for being on today and having, like I said, a very balanced analysis offered in his book, Promises to Keep. The show has been recorded, as I mentioned, on March 21st, by the time the show airs, we will be coming up on a couple of interesting guests. I'm looking forward to, in the following week, interviewing Professor Cass Sunstein from the University of Chicago on his book Infotopia. So I have another run of fascinating authors who are writing about quite cutting edge and challenging issues in technology and law. As always, you can hear this show not only live on KZSU 90.1 FM in the Bay Area, but also by going to CIS's Center for Internet Society's iTunes page, which you can find simply by typing Center for Internet and Society in your podcast search in iTunes. And you can also find the show through the CIS podcast feed at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. And finally, the relatively new website for Hearsay Culture, appropriately titled hearsayculture.com. I've been trying on my blog on hearsayculture.com to offer links to some of the items that are discussed on the show and make it that much easier for listeners to find information with regard to what we're discussing. Alas, my time is limited, and it takes quite a bit of time to prepare for the shows, and I love doing it, and I will do as much as I can to provide those links. At this point, I can't guarantee that I'll be able to put every last link onto the blog or otherwise make it as 100% useful as it could be. Perhaps in the future, with more time at my disposal, I will be able to do that. But I do thank you for listening to Hearsay Culture today. Do stay tuned for Mike and Baptism of Solitude, and I will talk to you next week.